oddly enough, we actually opened the year at Iowa, November 4th. So when he called me to tell me, this was done before he was going there and all this stuff, even before they made their coaching change. And so I told him already, I'm going to talk a ton of shit to him on November 4th. He said, I'm preparing already.
I'm tuned in, coach. I'm tuned in.
Welcome back to another episode of Not Even D2. I'm your host, KJ Allison, here with my guy, Neruda Perdomo. Really good episode where we talk with Robert Morris, head coach, Coach Andy Toole, coming off of a great season where he was Horizon League Coach of the Year, made it to NCAA tournament. Just a really good episode, talk about a lot. But last episode, before we get into this one, we talked about the winner of the NBA offseason. So today I kind of want to go on the flip side and do like the loser of the offseason. No shade toward any of these teams, but just like, maybe one of the teams that you're not really sure what their moves are. Talk to me.
Honestly, bro, I thought the Warriors, I didn't see any like transactions from them yet. Maybe they're waiting on a Kuminga deal, but you know, you have Steph right now, who's probably he's still playing at an all-star level, but you still have him in his prime. So you have to, you know, value that. So I'd say probably the Warriors. And then I don't know, we had talked about in episode, the chill session. We haven't dropped that yet, but you had talked about how the Brooklyn Nets, you thought they were going to trade one of their first round picks, and they drafted like three or four guards. So like, I'm kind of interested to see like what happens with the Brooklyn. I wouldn't say they're a loser, but it's just like more of a questionable decision by them. But those are my two teams, I'd say.
Yeah. With the Nets, bro, they're just constantly going to be beefing on who's getting more shots, MPJ or Cam Thomas. That's definitely a dumpster fire. I'm not sure where they're going, like you said. With the Warriors, I don't know how you feel about Kuminga, but I'm big on him. So I don't know why they haven't either locked him in or try to get, because I think the market out there, a bad team will definitely try to get Kuminga. So I'm definitely on the same side with both of those teams as you are. But my team, I'm going to say the Bucks, bro, because the main thing going into this offseason is you have to make sure that Giannis is happy and wants to stay in Milwaukee for the rest of his career. So the first thing you did was you waived Damian Lillard, Hall of Fame guard, which is like, okay, he was hurt next year. His contract's pretty big. But then you did that to get Miles Turner, as if Miles Turner is like, he moves the needle so far to a championship roster. So now you waive Damian Lillard, and there's reports that Giannis wasn't happy. You waive him, and then you're not really like a championship contender at this point. So now the question is still, do you trade Giannis, or does Giannis stay in Milwaukee? So that's definitely my team. They re-signed like some of their pieces that, you know, Bobby Portis, Torian Prince, guys that, you know, had pretty solid years for them last year, but I'm not really sure. Did they think that I'm not sure if they watched the playoffs. Miles Turner really wasn't, he wasn't a factor. He was kind of shooting really bad in the finals. So it's an upgrade from Brook Lopez, but to get rid of Dame for Miles Turner, I'm not really sure what they're doing with that.
Did you have a runner up or no?
A runner up? I mean, I think the safe bet is to, everybody's been clowning the Pelicans. I didn't want to say them, but just because they traded, you know, arguably a top five pick next year to move up 10 spots for Derek McQueen, but you also have Zion, and then they also signed Looney. So they have bigs in the room. It's kind of confusing why you have four centers on your team moving up spots and getting rid of a top five pick, arguably. So those are my two teams for sure.
No, that's fair. I think with the Pelicans, it's kind of an interesting situation because it's like, I think Joe Dumars thinks that team is going to be really good next year, and that pick won't be, because it's the Pelicans pick that they traded away, right? It's their first round.
It's whatever finishes worse. It's either the Pelicans or the Bucks. So there's the Bucks could finish last in the East, and then that pick is right back in the lottery top five, arguably.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, quick point. Yeah, Jeremiah Fears, I really like his game. They added Jordan Poole, who's, you know, solid. I'm pretty sure they still have DeJounte Murray, right?
Facts, but he's coming off Achilles too.
Yeah, he's recovering, but Zion coming back. I like, you know, I was saying Queen, I like Derrick Queen's game in that show session. I said that. So I think they could be solid, probably like a play-in type of team. I don't see them. I don't see them being horrible, though, honestly.
Yeah. No, I was saying I like that roster. Like, their starting five can be really good, but it's just like, the one, you're not competing for a title in the West, and then two, you're also not really building for the future at this point. So I don't know. But like I said, no shade against those teams. We're just not really high on their offseason grades. Let's talk about this episode. Coach Tuoto, really good episode. And the first point that I wanted, like, re-listening to some of the stuff he was saying, right now with the portal, a lot of coaches, you know, it can get hard. What player should I get? How do I, if we're going in the wrong direction, how do I change everything up to, you know, get back to the top? And Coach Tool kind of showed that it's fairly simple and just get back to the basics of basketball. What defenders are going to guard the basketball? What defenders are going to work hard? What people are going to come in and make this a competitive room? So I like that he kind of just boiled it down to the basics of basketball. Let's get back to, you know, the tradition of what made our program so good. And it showed to work. They made it to the NCAA tournament, won the Horizon League their first time. So shout out to Coach Tool for making that, you know, kind of clear in basketball where stuff is so hectic right now.
That's a great point. You know what I mean? I think, you know, it was a great episode with Coach Tool. He gave us a lot of good gems. And, you know, to your point, you're right. He kind of brought it down to the basics, right? You know, like you said, finding guys who guard, finding guys who can work hard, and finding guys who can shoot the ball too. And, you know, they had an amazing season this year in the Horizon League. I think we had mentioned the episode they switched over to the Horizon League 2 to 3 years ago, and now they're winning the conference. Like, that's a crazy accomplishment for Coach Tool, and he should be very proud of that. And, you know, watching them play in the tournament, I mean, that Alabama RMU game, it was a nail biter. I remember turning that on, and it was upset alert. You know what I mean? Obviously, they couldn't pull it out, but still, you could tell, like, they were a well-coached team, and they played super hard. And, you know, his career is stamped, you know, he's been around for you know, since he was a young coach. I think he got hired when he was 29 or 30 years old. So now I don't want to age him. I'm not sure how old he is today, but he's been at RMU for like 15, 16 years now. But he got a great career though, bro. I'm really, really happy that we got him on the pod. It was a great episode, and I'm excited, you know, for the viewers to get to know him.
Yeah, Coach Tool, good guy for sure. I saw that he just threw the first pitch for one of the Pirates games, which that's pretty tough. And he said this at the end, but just keeping that like humbleness or humility, regardless of what type of season they have. So now, like, he's getting all this credit or fame because Horizon League Coach of the Year, won the Horizon League, pushed Bama to, you know, last 5 minutes of the game, but he's still keeping like this level head and trying to build upon that. So I definitely respect that. I also seen on his gram, he was hooping in practice. Coach Tool still got it though. So we talked about him playing with his kids. He's still tough with it.
that was definitely a funny little segment. He was like, I still have a height and a physicality advantage over them. I don't know how old his kids are, but I thought that was kind of funny. He said that. But he was definitely a bucket back in the day at Penn, and we kind of talked about that. And that was a point I wanted to bring up was just about, you know, his own experience in the transfer portal, right? And how, you know, that helps him. He talked about how, you know, guys nowadays can have all the right answers in front of the coaches, but nevertheless, like, being able to, like, find the right guys for your system, you know, those JUCO guys, those guys that are slept on, and, you know, bringing them in, and they're really flourishing in his system. So it was a great conversation for sure.
Yeah. Last point, Alvaro versus RMU next year, definitely going to be on our radar. But it's just like tough for coaches because you spent, like, Coach Tool spent all this time recruiting Varo, getting him adjusted to America's college system, all that. And then he has a lot of success, but then leaves the next year. And I'm not saying he made the wrong decision or right decision, but I'm just saying, like, from a coach's perspective, it's tough. Like, you'll have an all-league guy, and now coaches can basically just offer a bigger number than you, and you're out of that race. So, like I said, it was a really good conversation. Let's cut this talk with us, and let's hear from Coach Tool. We are here with our guy, Coach Andy Toole. How you doing today, Coach?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Doing well. Appreciate you getting on, Coach. It's going to be a great episode. Talk to us a little bit about what you've been doing today.
As I kind of mentioned, as we started to, you know, kind of chat, we got day camp here at Robert Morris University. We got about 200 campers from third grade to ninth grade. Today is Championship Thursday. So we got a bunch of guys running around trying to win a prize or two and finish out camp strong.
Yeah, it's got to be hectic because you're also doing summer sessions and leading a basketball camp. So I can only imagine. But I'm kind of curious, do you watch any NBA, NFL, any other sports besides just strictly college basketball?
So I watch a ton of sports. I don't watch a ton of NBA till the playoffs come. So I watch the first week of the NBA just because it's the only basketball that gets on TV. You know, it starts before we start. I usually am locked in Christmas Day to kind of get an idea of where the world is at and rosters are at and who's on what team. And I think they compete on Christmas Day. And then I don't see much until the playoffs, maybe the last week of the regular season or so. Huge Knick fan. So that's been my squad since. There we go. Right. So I'm Knicks, I'm Mets, and I'm a Giant fan.
New York.
Yeah. So I grew up in New Jersey, so those are all my teams. So I watch a ton of the playoffs, as much as I can stay up for, you know what I mean? The West Coast games, I get to halftime and then I start to nod off, unfortunately. Watch a ton of NFL football, and we actually watch a lot of baseball. You know, I mentioned to you, I have two sons. They both really like baseball, and probably, you know, now they're going to be 13 and 11, probably 5-6 years ago. You know, when we'd be around this time, you know, in the evening, like anything my wife and I wanted to watch, they couldn't watch. And anything they wanted to watch, my wife and I didn't want to watch. And so we started watching, you know, Met games, Yankee games. My wife and my older son are Yankee fans. Me and my younger son are Met fans. So we have a little rivalry in the house. We watch Pirate games. You know, we go to a handful of games. So it's kind of become something that we kind of will just have on in the background as a family. Or, you know, I can kind of watch baseball and enjoy it. I'm not sitting there thinking about, like, when I watch an NBA game, I'm thinking about, you know, time, score, situation, what action they just ran. So you don't always like sit back and just relax and enjoy it. I can kind of do that with baseball and football, just be a fan of it more than trying to study and observe what's happening.
Nah, that definitely makes sense, Coach. I was going to say, if I'm not mistaken, I think KJ is a Steelers fan. Yep. And Robert Morris is in Pittsburgh. So I'm wondering, has that rubbed off on you a little bit or no?
So I don't know what your audience is in Pittsburgh, but you can't not follow the Steelers if you live in Pittsburgh because it's completely in your face all the time. When my kids first started going to daycare, Fridays was Black and Gold Friday. Like they're trying to like completely indoctrinate you into Steeler Nation. You know, I've lived in Philly. I've lived in Jersey. I lived in North Carolina, you know, where there's, you know, strong fandoms, right? Like Jets, Giants fans are strong. Eagles fans are crazy. The Steelers stuff is wild. I mean, Friday, you'll go to the supermarket and old women are walking around in Big Ben jerseys and, you know, it's just, it's a different level. Right. And so hard not to be aware of what they got going on. Secretly I get, and I'm a huge Mike Tomlin fan. I think he does a great job. He gets a bad rap in Pittsburgh a little bit, but I think what he does is awesome. Secretly, like when they lose, there's a little bit of like joy because everyone just loses their mind. So you can kind of just turn on sports talk radio the next day and, you know, the breakdown in the backup offensive line was the reason that we couldn't get over the hump. I mean, just like, it's so wild. But yeah, it's their fans are legit.
Yeah, it's I love Steel City, seeing the terrible tiles every Sunday, stuff like that. But so I went to school in Alfred, so it's right near Buffalo. Yep. And when you're surrounded by that culture where they're just diehard fans all around, it actually makes you kind of get a joy out of their sorrows or get happy when they lose. So I definitely understand what you're saying. But it's go Pittsburgh going into this year for sure. But let's talk about some basketball. So I want to talk about this past year for you guys. You were Horizon League Coach of the Year, first one of your career. Congrats to you. You guys 26-9, 15-5 in the Horizon League. First regular season title, tournament title. So just really good year. You made it to the NCAA tournament in a dogfight against Bama. So just talk about, you know, like this past year and getting back to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, it was a really important year for us, right? Obviously, anytime you have a chance, you know, to compete for a championship, win a championship, play in the NCAA tournament, that's the ultimate goal for mid-major schools is to be in the NCAA tournament. You know, going into last year, like if we were to sit and do this podcast 365 days ago, you know, I wasn't sure what we were going to become. You know, I thought that we came off a subpar season 2 years ago, one that kind of took us by surprise a little bit, because 3 years ago now we went 10-10 in the Horizon League after kind of coming out of COVID, felt like we were on the right track, took a step back 2 years ago, only won 10 games, really was disappointing in our ability to defend, our ability to do some of the things that since I've been associated with Robert Morris basketball have kind of been hallmarks of the program, the competitiveness, the defensive toughness, the urgency, the energy, the intensity that's been brought to the court by, you know, tons of players and coaches that have been a part of Robert Morris basketball for a long time. So it was a really disappointing year for me. Was really embarrassed about the product that we put out on the court. And so, you know, we kind of doubled down on guys that we felt played with the right edge, played with the right competitiveness, had the ability to defend. And we put a roster together of some guys that, you know, maybe people overlooked, maybe people undervalued. And as we got to this point, a couple weeks into the summer, we got guys on campus. The thing that hit me first and foremost about the group was our athleticism had improved dramatically. And we had some guys that really cared about winning or losing. There was a sense of pride when guys came into our workouts. And that was like a great relief to me, because as you go through some of the transfer portal situations or you're recruiting guys quickly in the springtime, you don't always know like what their makeup is. As much as everybody asks questions, guys are also good at giving the right answers. You know, like a lot of people are the best they ever are on their interview. And now when you got to live it every day, and in the summertime, we're not just doing, you know, shooting drills. Like we are practicing. We are, you know, I think like in the way that this works now, the springtime is kind of your off season, and then summer, fall, and winter is, you know, your prime time. And so we got to build who we are as a team. We got to build how we want to play. We got to start to put those things together as quickly as we can. So I love the kind of individual pride that guys had. And there were some moments in the summer last year where there was some tension and some guys competing, and that was fantastic. And I was just hoping that at some point that individual pride would become a collective pride. And as the year started, you know, you could kind of see us slowly getting better. Those intangible things we talked about were starting to show up more and more. Guys making big plays late in games, guys having poor performances and responding the right way by coming back and watching film, coming back and trying to improve. And that just grew as the year went on. And when we got to about Christmas, you could kind of sense guys were like, yo, we can be a team. Like we can become a good team. And the month of January, we kind of got on a little bit of a roll. And I still wasn't sure like what would shape up or how we would finish out. And then we won a game at Cleveland State. I think it was early February. And I kind of thought to myself, like, someone's going to have to beat us. You know, like, it's not like we're just going to check out in the tournament. Someone's going to have to beat us if we're, you know, they're going to have to knock us down. They're going to have to kill us in order to end up. We got some guys to fight. And our guys just continued to improve and get better and compete. And, you know, they were a great group to coach, a super fun group to be around, a lot of personality, a lot of energy. And I think they really became a team as the year went on. And that was really fun to be a part of.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, you need that type of energy in the gym, especially when you're bringing in a whole new group with the transfer portal and stuff like that. All those guys have something to prove, and it'd be easy for you to just be like, all right, guys, chill. We're all a team, but you need that drive in the locker room. Like, the person in front of me, I don't care if he's my team. I'm trying to outwork him today. And that's ultimately going to make you guys like, so when you're seeing another opponent, it's still up for them, but now you got that collective energy. So I like what you said there, but you mentioned how, you know, 2 years ago, you guys won 10 games, and I know how that must have felt as a coach. You're trying to, you know, rework everything, like what we're doing isn't working. So outside of just like the roster being different, turning over, what changed in your program, or what were some of the specific things you were changing, whether that's philosophy or, you know, offense, defense concepts, anything like that, that allowed you guys to, you know, be right back up on top of the Horizon League?
I mean, the biggest improvement we made from 1 year to the next was our defense. And like I mentioned, we just could not defend properly. We couldn't get stops or rebounds when we needed to. And I didn't think that our personnel really just couldn't do it. Like not that they were just like incapable. I just don't know how willing guys were. Mm. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I think as you kind of do that, you know, autopsy on your season, and you sit there and you look, you know, we had a couple staff changes that occurred. So we had some new energy, some new eyes that looked at our program as they, as new staff members came in. I think that certainly is always good. I've been here 18 years, so having guys that look at things kind of through a new lens is always helpful. But I think we doubled down on what we knew, and that was defending and rebounding. And then our offense kind of came along as the year went on, which on our best teams, that's how it's happened. The defense has won us games maybe early in the year or allowed us to compete early in the year. And then as guys continued to grow and get that connectivity offensively, then all of a sudden you had a team that was capable on both sides of the ball. And I think that that's kind of how the year went. And I think sometimes when your back's against the wall, you go into fight or flight, right? And the way I know how to fight is, you know, to get guys that want to go compete, that want to go defend, that want to go, you know, do all the little dirty things that it, you know, help you win games, hit the floor first, get a deflection, get an offensive rebound, you know, second, third, fourth efforts. And, you know, whether it was Marion Dickerson or Josh Omojafo or, you know, Cam Woods, DJ Smith, Ryan Prather, like all these guys that, you know, Varo Fulgaris, like these guys were competitors. You know, watching Omarion play in junior college, like charge takes, deflections, block shots, flying around, contesting shot. Like, I was like, that's one of the guys we need. Like, that's the kind of guy that we need. And so, you know, everybody kind of assumed that identity and played with that edge and that competitiveness. And that was really what it was. It was like, yo, let's go back to what we know works. Let's go back to the basics. Let's sit down in stances and guard, and let's do it every single possession. Or as close to every single possession as we can, and see where we fall from there.
Yeah. It's funny. A lot of coaches will say that like a big part of defense is like the want to play defense, right? Like you have to want to get a stop. Obviously, outside of like physical ability, but even if you don't have the physical ability, like having the mindset, like I said, to really sit down and get a stop.
Yeah, I talked to our team about that yesterday. It's like your talent kind of gets you the opportunity to be here. And obviously there's technique that's associated with defense and there's recognition and anticipation, but there's also a desire. Like I played for a guy named Fran Dunphy at Penn, and like we would say to Dunphy, like, how do you want us to guard that? He said, I don't care. Just get there, right? Like just get there. I don't care if you go over the screen, if you go under the screen, you go through the screen, you crawl, like you have to get there, right? And so yeah. Like that was kind of, now like we talk about some different strategies and ways that we want guys guarding things. But at the same time, you know, some of those guys that maybe don't always do it perfectly, but do it with great desire and willingness and want to figure out a way to get that contest or kind of make that play. And so, you know, those are some of the guys that I think you can win with because they're just going to go and try to figure it out as best they can, as often as they can. And that's going to give you a chance.
Yeah. I mean, like as a coach, if they get, there's no way you're going to get mad at your team for getting stops. So, right. It doesn't matter if you go into the game saying, all right, we don't want to be a switch team, but if your team just naturally is switching throughout that game, but they're getting stops, you're not going to call timeout like, yo, I didn't want you guys to switch. Right. So exactly what you're saying. But I want to talk about Alvaro. I'm bad at pronouncing names, just so you know. So I'm not going to try his last name. But so when I was watching the film on just your offense in general, I'm seeing a lot that like the guards were really poised when they get downhill and stopping on two, hitting the crack back, and you had a really good player to player of the year in Alvaro who can drive it, he can shoot it from the outside, attack a closeout. But I'm kind of curious, was this an offense implemented just for Alvaro? Because, you know, not many fives in the Horizon League are going to be able to, you know, stay with him from the three-point line all the way to the basket. Or do you constantly teach guys about playing off to being sound when you get into the paint?
Yeah, probably a combination of both, right? I think obviously like the offense that we run, we've been doing for a few years, kind of different years, it can kind of manifest itself a little bit differently based off personnel. A few years ago, we had a kid named Khalil Spear, who was a forward in the Horizon League, really versatile, straight line driver, right around the rim. You know, things with him similar to what we were able to do with Alvaro. You know, we need guys that are mobile. We need guys that can play in and around the basket as well as on the perimeter. You know, Omarion obviously fit that bill with his ability, you know, to straight line drive you, to catch and shoot, to cut. You know, there's a lot of movement, body and ball movement. Those guys need to be comfortable in two-man games and dribble handoffs, you know, in a lot of different scenarios, right? And then we're kind of reading and reacting from there. I think, like, when you have guys like Varo and Mar, it's almost like having a great tight end in football. Mm. You know, you put a small guy on a great tight end, Rob Gronkowski, or, you know, he's just going to bully him to death. And then all of a sudden, if you put that big linebacker on him, he's going to outrun him. And so there are constantly guys that you can utilize to create advantage, to put the defense in rotation. You know, Varo, I think, was our second or third leader in assists, right? Like, we could play through him.
He could pass.
He could see the game. You know, so those are some of the things that I think make guys like that unique. And it's like, what are the weaknesses of most defenses? Well, if we can get two on the ball and then we can figure out a way to continue to keep that advantage, which is what, you know, basketball is right now. You know, it used to be constant ball reversal, which we still have a lot of ball reversal in our offense because I think there's power in that. But, you know, trying to get those two on the ball, trying to have that advantage created, whether it's by a guard, like Cam was great at creating advantage. He would get the dominoes starting to fall in the right direction for us. We could do that with Varo. We could do that with Mar. And I think that led us to have great balance across the board, right? And then we had guys like Josh, DJ, Ryan Prather, Mar, who could finish all those plays, right? Whether it was a catch and shoot three, whether it was something at the rim. So now you got guys that are able to kind of get the advantage started, and then you have guys that can take advantage of the advantage when it occurs. And so that's where I think we became really good on the offensive side.
You're definitely right, Coach. A lot of basketball today, like you said, is about, you know, keeping advantages, finding the mismatches, and, you know, with your player Navarro, I mean, he can create those advantages and really playmake.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing I was wondering, I wanted to ask you about, was this matchup against Alabama in the first round of the NCAA tournament. It was a great game. You know, I remember when you guys came back, it was, I think it was around the 7 or 6 minute mark, you guys had tied the game or maybe gone up two. But I just want you to talk through, like, the scouting process when you were playing Alabama, because they have some dudes on that team, and just your mindset when you guys were coming back in that game.
Well, again, it's hard because, you know, those guys, you know, obviously one of the best offensive teams in the country, right? Like, if you look at all their offensive analytics, they're through the roof. The pace they play at, through the roof. The physical ability of some of those guys, you know, Big Cliff and, you know, Grant Nelson came in at the end of that game. I mean, the sheer size of some of those guys, you know, is something that it's hard to replicate, you know. So there's decisions you got to make, right? And, you know, if you study Alabama and you study Nate Oates and what he's done offensively, obviously he's huge from an analytics perspective of layups, free throws, and threes, right? And they don't take mid-range jumpers very often. And almost like the NBA, right? Everything in the NBA now is layups, free throws, and threes. But when you watch the playoffs, there's a lot of middies because every defense is geared for no layups, no fouls, and no threes. Facts. So we kind of went into it with the approach of, like, trying to utilize that to understand how we could try to force them into some of those areas of the floor to shoot those shots. The first half, our ball screen defense was a little bit poor. Cliff was able to get behind Alvaro's head for a handful of lob dunks. Thank God for technology, and we were able to show some film at halftime to kind of clean and tighten that up a little bit, which we didn't allow as many of those opportunities in the second half. We kind of forced them into some tougher twos or some contested threes. We did a good job of guarding the three-point line. And then I think we started to kind of get comfortable and attack offensively on our end, right? And it's like, okay, what do you got to lose? Let's attack. Let's try to get out, see if we can get a couple easy ones. See if we can get them moving around. I think in my experience against some high majors at times, those guys are so good at that initial help. They're not always great at the recovery. And so when you get that initial help, if you can then move it and move it again, you're usually going to have a good opportunity for a shot or a drive again. And I think we were able to start to do that. And so we did. We took the lead about 7 minutes. We had a open three on the next possession. We got to stop after we took the three, or after we took the lead. And Ryan Prather had a open three on the right wing, and I think the entire building, like, held their breath. Like, it was just like one of those ones where if that thing goes, the roof comes off. And we had a great turnout, you know, because obviously we're close, about an hour and 40 minutes from Cleveland, so we had a ton of fans there. Obviously we were the underdog, so at that point in time, I think all the Vandy and St. Mary's fans were rooting for us, and that thing went in and out, and everyone just kind of exhaled. They ended up taking the lead after that, and then we were fighting upstream. But you know, just proud of the way that our guys competed. I knew they weren't going to back down. There was just too much pride, too much competitiveness for that within the locker room. I knew they were going to put up a great fight. But sometimes as you get down the line, you need a couple things to go your way. And obviously Alabama was able to make a few more plays.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, because Nate Oates is like a legendary coach, and at this point you're kind of, I don't want to say at that level, but you've built a resume high enough to be on that level. But early in your career, I saw that you beat Kentucky back in the day. You played against Jim Boeheim and Syracuse. So I'm just kind of curious what that was like as a younger coach, trying to like compete against those type of guys.
Yeah, I think it's like, I think initially, like, just being a head coach period is daunting. I think the first exhibition game I coached, you know, the first time you're kind of standing up there all by yourself and you're responsible for everything that goes on the court, that feeling is wild. You know, you're just sitting there going like, you know, holy, you know, I'm responsible for all this, you know, turnover, bad shot, you know, whatever. And so it really drives you to make sure that you're as prepared as you can be for your team. And I think that's what I try to focus on. You know, we've had, you know, games against Roy Williams and games against Cal and, you know, on down the line, right? Some of the best coaches ever. And we've gotten our heads handed to us by some of them. We've competed with some of them. So at this point, I think you just try to focus in on your own team and what you can do for your team and how you can prepare them best, how you can give them the best feedback, how you can try to, you know, make sure that coming out of timeouts, they're prepared for whatever might be happening next. And that's your responsibility. You can't really be worrying about who's down the other sideline. You got to be worrying about your guys and your team. And I think that that helps keep the focus in the right place, because it's obviously, if you start worrying about the guy on the other end, you know, you're not doing the best job you can for your team, and your responsibility is to do that.
100%, Coach. I mean, but you could just tell, like, watching your guys play, like playing against Alabama, like there was no fear in Dickerson's heart when he was going to the rim. Like he was just playing like, you know, like who, like it didn't matter where these guys was in the mock draft or where they were, you know, rated in high school. All your guys were just attacking them, and you love seeing that for mid majors at the end of the day.
Yeah, you absolutely do. And I think that that's the only way you are going to have a chance. You know, yeah. Oakland, who was our league champion last year, they beat Kentucky in the first round. Same thing, same mindset. Like, you know what? We're coming out here to play. We're coming out here to do what we do. You know, we obviously know there's going to be some advantages that our opponent has, but let's figure out what we can do to make it as difficult as possible. Let's figure out what we can do, you know, to be as comfortable as we can be. And I think that's the trick, right? When you play, I played against some high major guys, and all of a sudden some simple things like inbounding the ball or, you know, being in your gap, which you've done 1,000 times, you're just a little bit less comfortable because the guy that's you're guarding is, you know, 6'7" instead of 6'4", or is a projected, you know, mock draft guy versus, you know, just another guy in your league. And so that just makes you a little bit less comfortable. And the trick is, how do you just play your game? How do you just do the things that you've done to get you there? How do you just understand how to react and worry about those small little things that all of a sudden allow you to become more comfortable, so you can give yourself a chance to be able to win and pull the upset?
I mean, talent shows at the end of the day. Omarion Dickerson, 11 for 22, 25 in the game, really elite numbers from him. And obviously Alvaro had a solid game too, 15, 6 of 12. So all around, your guys really came to play. But I want to talk about your experience in the NCAA tournament for a second, because as a player, you went to 2 back-to-back NCAA tournaments with UPenn, and you talked about being coached by Coach Dunphy. And I wanted to ask, you know, you had some notable names on that roster, like obviously yourself, but tell me if I'm pronouncing the name right. Onyekwe, is that how you say his last name?
Yep. You got Onyekwe. Yep.
He was a dog at UPenn. And then, you know, D3 currently now, you know, coaching at Florida. Dave Klatsky, Coach Klatsky, he was on that team as well. So just first talk about your memories, you know, from those 2 years at UPenn. But the specific game that I want to talk about is when you guys played Tony Allen in Oklahoma State, because Tony Allen, that's first team all defense.
So Dave and I, the first time we played together, we were 10. We grew up in the same area and played with or against Dave, like all the way growing up, played together 10-year-old AAU, played together 16-year-old and 17-year-old AAU. We actually lost in the AAU national championship. And back then AAU was like the real deal. Like it was, you know, we play, like we had one day we played like Boo Williams in the morning and Atlanta Celtics in the afternoon. Like there was no sneaker circuits. So everybody went to the AAU nationals. And our 16-year-old year, we lost in the finals to Tulsa Rebels. And our 17-year-old year, we lost in the finals to a team out of Shreveport, Louisiana, Hollis Price, who played at Oklahoma, actually hit the game-winning shot in the AAU national championship. And it was myself, it was Dave. We had a guy named Taj Holden who played at Maryland on their national championship team in 2002. guy named Sean Exani, who played at Rutgers. Dante Jones, who played at Rutgers and Duke, was with us for our 17-year-old year. Kid named Chris Adams, who played at Elon. So we had like six Division I guys on the team. Really good team, really fun experience. And then I went to Elon my first 2 years, and I transferred to Penn. And my goal was always to be a play in the NCAA tournament. Like I loved college basketball. I loved being a part of you know, the environment, the you know, watching the tournament every year. My dream was always to pull a first round upset. I wanted to be that team that pulls that first round upset. And so my junior year, we went to the NCAA tournament. It was the first time I ever came to Pittsburgh, and we lost to Cal Berkeley in the first round. We were down one at half. Didn't play our best game. We had like a kind of a crazy way of getting to the NCAA tournament, because in the Ivy League at the time, there was no tournament. And so we had a really good start to our season. My junior year, we wanted Georgia Tech to start the year. We beat Iowa State. We lost to Illinois when Bill Self was the coach there, and we were up 12 at the half. We lost the game. So we had a really good team, beat Villanova, beat Temple, won the Big Five. And then we start Ivy League play, and we're 2-3. And basically, like, it's like our season could be over. So we won the next 9 games to force a playoff. And we beat Yale in a playoff to go to the NCAA tournament. And so I think, like, when we got to the tournament, we were probably a little bit, not that we didn't want to win the game, but we were a little bit relieved to be there. And, you know, it was my first experience being there. Some of the other guys on the team had been there as freshmen, but it was kind of like our first time being there where we were all, you know, responsible and playing heavy minutes. So we lost to Cal Berkeley. They had like 4 7-footers, they had a good team. Shante Leggins, who's at Portland now, was on that team. Dennis Gates, who's the coach of Missouri, was on that Cal team. You know, so it was just, again, all basketball world is all incestuous, right? Yeah. So then my senior year, we went undefeated in the Ivy League. We went 14-0. Uganda was back-to-back player of the year. Coco Archibong was on our team. It was another really good player. So we went 14-0. We went to the NCAA tournament, played Oklahoma State. It was a 6-11 game. We were an 11 seed. The first year we were a 10 seed, it was a 7-10 game. And I think one of the things that hurt us was that everyone was picking us to win. And everybody was kind of looking at us as like, hey, maybe this is a team that can win a game. We had basically our whole starting five back. Our first couple of guys off the bench were back. And Tony Allen was a sophomore, and he was like their fourth option. So they had a dude named Victor Williams who had like 27 on us. He was fantastic. Andre McFarlane was a dude on the inside who was a killer. But Tony Allen was like, he literally was like, we always laugh. We had a freshman that started for us, this guy named Tim Begley, and he was matched up with Tony Allen. He's like, dude, I was guarding Tony Allen. We're like, yeah, and you were our worst defender. Like, you were the guy that was production right now. Then all of a sudden he becomes like a, you know, 15-year NBA vet, all defensive team player. And obviously you could tell like his athleticism and his competitiveness and his intensity. And same deal. We actually had the ball with like 3 seconds left in the half. We ended up getting, oddly enough, we ended up getting a 6-man on the court technical.
Damn.
So we had gotten a stop. There was like 3 seconds left. Coach Dumpf like runs like 3 starters back into the game, and only 2 guys go off the court. And so the ref hands the ball, and the guy inbounding is like, no one's open. And then somebody was open because they were unguarded. It was Dave Klotsky. And they go to throw the ball to him, and he steps off the court because he realizes there's 6 of us out here. And the refs then figure it out, and they got 2 free throws to be up 1 going into the half. And then we battled in the second half. We were down 4 with like 2 minutes to go, and then kind of didn't make a couple plays, had to foul, and the game kind of got stretched a little bit. But yeah, it was disappointing because I think that was, you know, the hope was that, you know, you'd be able to kind of have that upset. We actually, if we had won that game, we would have played Syracuse in the next round, and that was Carmelo Anthony's freshman year. Wow. We had 5 guys, so we got there early because Syracuse played, I think, Manhattan before us. Bobby Gonzalez was the coach of Manhattan, and we were sitting there watching, and it was like Melo, Hakeem Warwick, they had a guy named Jerry McNeil. That was like their back line, and it looked like there was like one hand on the sideline over here, and another, and everybody's hands were touching as they like covered the entire, like, sideline to sideline.
That zone got, let them long guys just did demon. But
we had five guys that shot 40% from three. So in our mind, we were like, yo, we're just going to let these things rip. Like, this is going to be, you know, no one's going to be able to start. We're not driving to the rim. We're just jacking threes all day. So we kind of were hoping to maybe get that matchup. But unfortunately, Oklahoma State was too good. And like I said, in the post-game press conference, those guys, you know, because you're standing out there as they're finishing up, and they were all talking about how everybody picked us to win and that gave us extra motivation, and, you know, all those kind of things where sometimes you hope you can sneak up on somebody that doesn't really realize you guys have a team. But Eddie Sutton was their coach and obviously a legendary Hall of Fame coach. So I don't think he was going to allow that to happen. And we came up a little short.
That's definitely a cool story, Coach. And it's just, you know, for you as a coach, I'm sure, you know, you've been to two NCAA tournaments. So now, you know, I don't really know the answer to this, but that may influence you to work that much harder to get your team to an NCAA tournament.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think like the experience you have at the NCAA tournament, and it's dumb stuff. It's like getting a police escort. You know, at that time in the early 2000s, like, you know, like every team in the country now, if you go in their locker room before a game or at halftime, there's snack table and all this kind of stuff. Like, we walked in the tournament for our practice, and there was like a cooler of drinks. We thought it was like the craziest thing we've ever seen in our life. Like, you know, cold, you know, Powerades or Gatorades or waters or whatever. We were like, man, we're living. Like, this is crazy. You know, like, because that wasn't the deal. Like, no, you had like a, you know, you had a, you know, a cooler of water in your locker room that was what you were utilizing, you know, to be able to hydrate. Now these guys have got, you know, every, you know, they're pouring, you know, different flavor stuff in their water and, you know, noon tablets and LMNTs and, you know, like all this hydration stuff. I mean, it's just, so it's way different, but those kind of things are so special and so unique that it makes you want to be a part of it. Like when you hear your name called on Selection Sunday, there's nothing better. Like all the work you've done just feels like it was like the easiest thing ever because the gratification that you get from hearing that. And so having been twice as a player, I was there twice as an assistant, three times as a head coach. Like, you want that feeling. You want your guys to experience that feeling, and you're begging and pleading and fighting with them every day to try to get them to control all the things that they can so you can give yourself a chance. Because even if you do that, it's not guaranteed. You're just giving yourself a chance, and you want to give yourself the best chance, and you want to hope that things kind of fall in your favor and you get a chance to experience it because there's nothing else like it.
100%, Coach. I mean, like you said, you got to give yourself the best chance, and you guys definitely did that this year. You know, and one thing that you mentioned, obviously, you know, went to Elon for your first year and then you transferred to UPenn. So I'm wondering, now you talked about how it's tough to really determine what transfers look like coming into college now. But I'm wondering if your own transfer experience kind of helps you understand where these players are coming from. And, you know, another note too, be able to evaluate talent as well.
It definitely helps because, you know, I played my first 2 years at Elon, and in my second year. And this is going to be a humble brag, I guess. I think I led us in like points, minutes, assists, 3-point percentage, steal. I mean, like a lot of categories. And we were like around 500. And I didn't really know, like, this is like 2000, right? So like, I didn't really know, like, I didn't know anything about transferring, and you had to get a release to transfer. So you had to go in and talk to your coach, and that was like an intimidating thing. But I had kind of done all this, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to transfer. I didn't really know like what I wanted to do. So I went in to go talk to my coach because I was frustrated. Like, I'd been a part of a good high school program, and, you know, there was like a standard of how everything was supposed to be done. And, you know, not that there's not different ways to be successful. I just didn't fully understand, you know, kind of some of the mindset and mentality at times. And, you know, I wanted to go to the NCAA tournament. I wanted to win. I want to be better. I want to work harder. We want to do all these different things. And so I was frustrated. So I went in to talk to my coach, and he basically said, if that's the way you feel, you should leave. Right. Because if you wanted to transfer, like, there was something wrong with you. It wasn't, there was something wrong with the program or, you know, whatever. And so I was kind of like on my heels at that point. He's like, I'm real big on trust. And if that's the way you feel, you know, I think you should go. And I didn't really know like how to completely process that. So I kind of left, and I called my parents and was like, yo, this is how the meeting went. Didn't go well. Right. And then the next day, like, some of the assistants called me, and they were saying like, hey, you should stay and blah, blah, blah. And I, well, the meeting didn't go real well. And so then the following Monday, I sat down with my head coach and the associate AD at the time. My dad drove down and they basically said, like, if you ask for your release, we're not going to renew your scholarship for next year. And never like, hey, like, what are your frustrations? Or, you know, what do you think we can do to be better? Or is there something that, you know, is going on that we don't know about, right? And so I think they kind of tried to, you know, bully me into staying to some extent. And at that point in time, I knew I had to leave, right? And I loved school there. I had great friends there. I had great relationships there, great social life there. It was like beautiful campus, beautiful school, all this kind of stuff. So to your point, I think about that a lot when guys come in to talk to me, right? One, you know, sometimes it is best if guys leave, and sometimes that is the conversation. Sometimes it is like, well, what don't you, you know, what else are you looking for? What do you think is going to be out there? You know, so I don't immediately jump to, you know, you should definitely go. There's times where like both parties know, man, it's time to go. And, you know, there's times where even this year, some guys went, I said, okay, just so you know, like this could be what's out there for you. These are some of the questions or some of the issues you might have. Because again, at the end of the day, you can't force someone to be here, and you want guys that want to be here, right? But you also want to try to give the right information to say, hey, this is the pros and cons of this decision, because every decision has consequences. Mine ended up working out well, but there's a lot of guys that don't necessarily have that same ability. There's some guys that have left here that have gone on to some great things and some great places, and we're happy for that. There's some guys that have gone on and haven't really found their way. And that's disappointing as well, because you feel like maybe you could have helped them, you know, stay on the right track or reach their potential or do whatever. And so you definitely kind of take all those things into consideration when having those conversations with guys, because at the end of the day, it's supposed to be about what's best for them, you know, and you can give your 2 cents. But you hope at least they understand you had an understanding and a conversation with them about, you know, what it looks like out there.
Yeah. I mean, this conversation kind of relates to something I wanted to talk about with Alvaro. First, I want to just hear a little about like recruiting him, because I know he's from Spain. He went to DME in high school, but I know he's from Spain, played for the national team. But I want to hear, if you can, talk about like those conversations, because he ended up transferring to Iowa this past year after winning Player of the Year in the Horizon League. So I'm just curious how you were trying to, you know, navigate that conversation with him. Like, yeah, you could probably go make more money, yeah, it's high major, but I assume that you wanted him to come back. So just talk about that situation.
Yeah, I think it'd be crazy if I didn't want him to come back. I mean, I wanted to have everybody back. It would have been great, right? And obviously the landscape is different now than it was with the NIL and those opportunities, which even, you know, make it, you know, that much harder to stay somewhere, you know, if you are successful. But you know, Varo was an interesting situation. You know, he came here to visit. He didn't speak great English. His mom spoke no English. His brother, who plays in Ireland, speaks good English. His mom and his brother came on the visit. His brother almost has like an Irish accent, which is kind of funny. Like he pronounces some words, you know, with an Irish accent, which is like mind blowing. So like we're having these dinners in this visit, and like I'm not sure what's like getting translated, and you're not really sure what everybody kind of grasping onto, you know, and you get very few words out of Varo. I mean, he's got a huge personality, but we didn't know it at the time. And obviously I think he was a little bit intimidated because he didn't really, you know, speak the language as comfortably. He's gotten good at saying the F word, and he says that's what he's learned from me. So that's always great. But, you know, like over the 2 years that he was here, you know, you saw the growth. You know, I thought he would have a really good sophomore season. I didn't know he'd quite have as good a season as he had. And it's funny because after the season was over, his agent was here for the NCAA tournament. His brother was here for the NCAA tournament. And, you know, we sat and talked, and we had already tried to like generate as much NIL as we could. And I think it wasn't even close to what he ended up getting, you know, at Iowa, which I completely understand. You know, I tried to make a very, you know, average case, I guess, for him staying for one more year to kind of continue to improve strength, continue to improve in some areas that I thought would just help him adjust to that Power Five level easier in a year. You know, we tried to, you know, we talked to some NBA people that, you know, had discussed the idea of like mid-major guys that stay at the same place and continue to improve and grow, or guys that, you know, have kind of found a home in the NBA. Sometimes the guys that transfer up, they get lost in the shuffle or maybe don't have the same production, and so they don't always get the same opportunity. You know, so we tried to talk about some of those things with him, but ultimately he felt like, you know, he had done what he needed to do here and there was nothing more, you know, that he could do. I disagreed. I think if you do things, you know, in a back-to-back situation or, you know, like those things even are even louder, you know.
Yeah, your stock goes up for sure.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, but again, at the end of the day, sometimes it's hard to also compete with, you know, if there was no money at all, maybe you'd have a chance. Now when you're talking about, you know, 10X, 20X, you know, it's like you can't fight that fight. And, you know, I think he's picked a good spot. Oddly enough, we actually opened the year at Iowa, November 4th. So when he called me to tell me, this was done before he was going there and all this stuff, even before they made their coaching change. And so I told him already, I'm going to talk a ton of shit to him on November 4th. He said, I'm preparing already.
I'm tuned in, coach. I'm tuned in.
But we had a great relationship, and we'll continue to have a great relationship, and I'll always support him and his family. And, you know, he's close with my kids, you know, like he'll, you know, he was over, you know, before he left, you know, he had to come over and see my family and all that kind of stuff. And that's the part that's awesome. It's also the part that's sad a little bit because, you know, you sometimes wish you could have those guys for two more years, you know, like, you know, Mar walking in your office every day, straight comedy, you know, and there'll be other guys that kind of fill that void and do that stuff. But sometimes as a coach, you wish they could be here for as long as they could because, you know, you enjoy being around them, you know, the good days, the bad days, you know, the ups, the downs, the fights, you know, the laughs, you know, all those things are part of what creates some of those relationships. And, you know, you unfortunately in the age of everybody moving year to year, you miss out on some of that.
Nah, for sure. Definitely, you know, great points that you talked about. And you're right. I mean, NIL definitely has changed, you know, the landscape of college basketball and, you know, how mid-majors kind of keep talent and acquire talent. But we are seeing, you know, we interviewed Amari Monroe, who went to Quinnipiac this past year. And he had, he was in the transfer portal. And he had a bunch of Power Five offers and he ended up staying there at Quinnipiac. So, you know, it's definitely to your point about, you know, mid-majors staying at the school and still getting to the NBA and carving out a role. There's definitely precedent for that. And, you know, talking about just navigating road bumps for yourself, you know, you became a coach at around 29 to like 31 years old, if I'm not mistaken, or head coach rather,
yeah.
At that age. And compared to your peers, that's relatively a young age. And I'm just wondering some of the road bumps that you had to navigate, you know, early on in your career. And this is going to be the last question before we go to break as well.
Early on, I have some gray hair now, but, you know, 15 years ago, we would walk into gyms and, like, you know, the people were saying, like, where's the head coach? You know, I mean, like, I'm me right here. You know, like, I looked like I was still, like, a player's age. So that was part of it. I think the guys that were on my teams early on, I knew because I was an assistant here, so I knew them. I helped recruit some of them. So I think there was a comfort level there. There was a respect level there that I could kind of do the job and I could help them, but you don't fully know because you've never done it. You know, officials, you get very little respect from the officials when you're 29, 30 years old and you're standing on the sidelines. And, you know, so you got to try to navigate some of those things. You know, so there's a lot of roadblocks. You know, I always had good institutional support from RID, our president. You know, we now have new ADs and new presidents and they've been great as well. You know, so that certainly helps. But I think you got to just try to focus on, again, doing the job the best you can, preparing your team every day in your practices, being efficient with your time with them, having answers or helping them find answers that can allow them to get better. You know, and I think that that's part of your job as a coach. And that's what I tried to focus on. You know, I think, you know, when you coach at a place like Robert Morris, you have good years, you have bad years. Sometimes, like, you need different experiences to kind of, like, humble you to some extent. And so, you know, we've had bad years where I'll walk into a gym or a restaurant or whatever, and, you know, people have no idea that I coach or what our record is, you know. And then there's years like, you know, this where you have a good year and people have no idea whether you – and you try to keep that perspective, you know what I mean? Like, because a lot of people got a lot of different things going on in their world. And, you know, We have people that care about our program deeply. We have players that care about our program deeply, coaches that do, supporters that do. We try to do the best job and put the best team on the court that we can for them. But you also have to have a little bit of perspective of, like, at the end of the day, you're sitting here dying because you just had a bad practice and you roll into, you know, a restaurant or you roll into a gym to watch your kids play. And, you know, people could give two shits about how your practice went. They're not worried one bit. And I think that helps keep me kind of, balanced in, you know, making sure I'm doing the best job I can, but not thinking that you're something more than, you know, I get to coach basketball. I'm a pretty fortunate guy.
Yeah, 100%. I respect that humility, but I've definitely seen a few interviews when you were really young, and I was like, yo, this is crazy, like the transformation. So I got to commend you too, because just how you speak in interviews and all that, you could definitely see the growth in you as a head coach. So stay with us while we take a quick break. We are back with Coach Tool on the Not Even D2 pod. So you guys won the NEC in 2020, which ended up getting canceled. The NCAA tournament got canceled because of COVID. But soon after, I think it was in June, it was announced that you guys would be moving to the Horizon League. And obviously, this changes a lot in your program. But I'm kind of interested if you could talk about your perspective, how the news of moving to the Horizon League came about, but also some of the adjustments you instantly had to make, because no shade toward the NIC or NEC, but that's low major. And now you're moving to a mid-major program with, you know, known programs like Wright State, Cleveland State, like high esteemed programs. So just talk about, you know, that move.
Yeah, it was a little bit of an emotional roller coaster, because you mentioned, you know, we won the NEC tournament in 2020. We just opened a brand new arena. You know, we host the championship. It was kind of the last event. March 10th, I think, was the date. You know, and it's like you're as high as you possibly can be as a program. And then, you know, the tournament gets canceled, and then everyone got sent home. That was the worst part. Like, the tournament got canceled, everyone got sent home. So you didn't even get to, like, we had like one meeting after the tournament got canceled, and everyone had to go home. So you didn't even get a chance to really, like, grieve with the players on the team. And we had some great dudes on that team, who had some awesome seasons. And, you know, again, their goal was to be a part of that NCAA tournament, and they kind of got it robbed. And then, you know, I wouldn't say out of the blue, I think there was some speculation that, you know, there was opportunity for us to change leagues at some point in time. But that June, you know, I got a call saying, hey, you know, this is going to happen. And, you know, next week we're having a press conference, and you couldn't go out and recruit. You know, you couldn't really add anybody to your roster. So we went into that first year. And, you know, I'll say this publicly, I don't know if we should have played, you know, and not because I was scared of COVID, and obviously some of the, you know, there's some tough situations, but it was just kind of a little bit unfair to student athletes. You know, we had guys that would be in quarantine for 14 days, and then they'd come out and have to come to practice. And, you know, we were talking about, okay, if you take a bus ride, you know, can the left side of the bus eat first and then the right side of the bus eat second? Like, I mean, like, just some of the stuff that we thought was going to be helping keep everyone safe. Like, I almost felt like if we have to go to this level of extremes, what are we doing? You know, like, what are we doing? And so it was really hard, you know, and obviously we're playing, you know, another level of competition. We're not having success. Our practices are, you know, choppy. We got like one group that kind of had COVID early, and then some other guys were in quarantine, and then some other guys got it. And, you know, it just was like not a year that, you know, seemed fair to the student athletes. And I think obviously one of the reasons they gave them that extension of the clock, you know, to be able to have that extra year, because it really, you know, it wasn't like any other season that anyone had ever been a part of. And then we couldn't go out and recruit again that next year. We still weren't allowed to go to live events. We still, like, so everything was done on Zoom. Everything was done on tape. Transfer portal had just started. So that kind of now created this whole nother level of, you know, confusion. You know, we went out and we added a bunch of transfers the second year, and the chemistry just didn't really work out great, but we were still trying to, you know, we were trying to get more talent, but we were also trying to make sure that we could compete in the Horizon League. And our second year, you know, a little bit better, but not much, because, you know, we just didn't get some of the right people in the room. And so, you know, those first couple of years were really frustrating, and it was almost like, you had gone from, you know, being a championship level program to being now at the bottom of a program and trying to figure out how to figure out a way to fight your way back. And then that's with the transfer portal and NIL coming on the forefront to be able to try to, like, you know, overcome, you know, some of those challenges and figure all that stuff out on the fly. And, you know, so it's been hard, you know, but obviously this year, you know, we were able to kind of put things together and have some success. And now, you know, the challenge is to keep that stuff moving in the right direction and continue to put a team out there that's going to be, you know, championship caliber.
100%, Coach. I mean, you know, we definitely be giving you a lot of respect and commending you for some things, but hearing that story about how you guys had to, you know, battle through COVID, battle through NIL, move into a new conference, and now you guys are coming out on top 3 to 4 years later. That's a big accomplishment, Coach. And, you know, I know you're probably not taking that lightly, but you definitely should be proud of yourself and the program for sure.
Yeah, I think there was like a sense of, you know, like when we won the championship this year, there was like a moment where, like, you know, like there was a major sense of I don't want to say relief, but there was a major sense of like, I can't believe like all this came together. You think back to some of those things that, you know, some of those tough ride homes or those tough nights after losses in the last couple of years, going like, how are we going to get this thing going in the right direction? Like, I believe we have a good plan. I believe we know what we're doing. You know what I mean? But kind of being able to stay with that and then seeing all of it come to fruition was really satisfying.
Keeping faith, man. That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest thing for sure. I love hearing that, Coach. And, you know, like you mentioned, I mean, you guys are stamped now in the Horizon League. You guys coming off a conference championship, right? Regular season championship, 26-9, NCAA tournament appearance. So I got to hear what's in store for the Army program next.
Well, I mean, hopefully we can have a chance to go back, you know, to the NCAA tournament again. I think, you know, every team, as they get together in the summer, you know, you ask your guys, what are the goals? And I think some of the guys were attracted to our program that we brought in because of our success last year and because of us going to the NCAA tournament. And, you know, they don't always understand how hard it is to get there, you know, and that's our job as coaches, is to kind of guide them through that and to help set the system and set the steps that they got to hopefully follow, you know, to give themselves the chance to be there. But we have one returning guy in Ryan Prather. We got 10 new guys that are on our roster. We'll have 3 true freshmen, you know, a couple of JUCO guys, a handful of transfers. And I think we have the makings of becoming a good team. But, you know, we'll wait and see until November when we actually get on the court and the lights come on. But right now we're just trying to get guys acclimated to how we work, what our terminology is, some of our base offense and defense. And as we go through the summer, you're also trying to get to know the new guys on your team, how they respond to different things. You know, what are some of the instincts they have from a basketball perspective? And because you don't always have guys that are here for like 2, 3, or 4 years, I think as you get guys on your campus and they start to play, you've got to have your antenna up as a coach, say, you know, what are the things that we can identify early on that are going to help them adjust and be more successful to what we're doing, right? A couple of years ago, we kind of toyed with our offense a little bit, became a little more 5-out. Then last year, as we started in the summer, we had some guys that, you know, just out of their habit were rim running, right? And so we said, like, okay, why are we going to fight these guys every day to get them to be 5-out and stop at the 3-point line when their instinct is to run to the rim, and that can be effective for us? So why don't we kind of adjust and adapt and say, okay, how can we utilize this instead of, like, you know, just beating your head against the wall, try to figure out how to be able to use some of the things that guys already do instinctually and just add it and adapt it to what you are already doing. So I think that that's, you know, one of the challenges now that coaches kind of have to face is, you know, kind of taking groups, identifying some of their strengths and weaknesses, and then figuring out how you can put those together in a short amount of time based off what you already do and know can be successful to best utilize their skill set.
For sure. I mean, you know, a big part of coaching is being able to adapt on the fly, you know, whether it's off season, whether it's in season. So, you know, definitely excited for, you know, RMU basketball this season. KJ and I got to get up to Pittsburgh at some point this upcoming year, catch some games for sure.
That'd be great.
Yeah, for sure. We'll definitely talk about it. But at the end of these episodes, we do rapid fire and top 5, Coach. Okay. So are you ready for rapid fire or no?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do it. So first rapid fire question. So who was – actually, no, let me just start off with this. What was the toughest player you ever had to scout against?
Jahlil Okafor.
Tough.
Yeah.
Who's number two? I got to hear a second one.
Number two, Carson Edwards at Purdue.
That was my goal. I thought he was going to be the truth.
I mean, that dude could get a shot off in a second. He had legs like Saquon Barkley. That dude was so strong.
Yeah.
Sure. His run with Purdue in the tournament was special for sure.
Yep.
Do you – next rapid fire question. Do you have any superstitions? Because I know as players sometimes, you know, we're playing in college, we'll have superstitions before the game. So as a coach, has that carried over for you or no?
I used to have very minimal superstition. Like when I was a player, I would have like, you know, gummy bears and, you know, like a Red Bull and, you know, like I had all that kind of what my pregame routine was. I don't have as much as a coach because I think that your mind will explode if you get too down the road of superstitions. So I don't have any per se that, usually I'm down on the court 2 hours beforehand and, you know, there's a couple of things that are, you know, kind of keep me consistent, but nothing completely superstitious.
Fair. That's fair. And then third rapid fire question. So you said you have two sons right now. I'm just wondering, are you still playing them one-on-one? And what is the cutoff age to when you're going to stop playing them one-on-one?
The cutoff age will be if they can come close to beating me. That'll be when we stop. I still will mess around with them and play one-on-one, you know, to some extent. I still have a pretty dominant size and strength advantage. But as that gap starts to shrink, the one-on-one games might become a little more infrequent.
That's funny. I'm rooting for your kids to catch up pretty soon. But we're going to move to the starting five edition. So if you're a coach, assembling a lineup, point guard through center, who's your lineup going to be? And this edition is going to be the best players that you played against throughout your college career.
That I've played against?
So just tell me where they played at and where they would play in your position.
So, so my point guard is Jameer Nelson. This is a good question. The center is Brian Cook, played at Illinois.
Okay.
The two guard is Lynn Greer, who played at Temple.
It's a throwback.
I guess we'll call him a wing, three man, Vincent Yarborough, who played at Tennessee. You guys can do some research on Vincent Yarborough.
These are some names that I'm not really knowing.
And then trying to think if I'm missing anybody. Four man. Four man is a guy. Maybe I'll put Yarborough at the four, and I'll put Rasul Butler at the three.
Okay. I think I heard that name before.
He unfortunately passed away, but he played in the NBA LaSalle, played in the NBA for probably close to a decade.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's definitely some good competition you've seen throughout your career. But that's going to do it for another episode of Not Even D2. We definitely appreciate you getting on this show. It's been a good conversation. And I'm looking forward. You said it was November 4th of ours coming?
No, we're going there. Tuesday, okay. November 4th. I tried to get him to come here, but that wasn't happening. So we're at Iowa Tuesday, November 4th.
So we'll be tuned in, and best of luck to you and the future endeavors.
Appreciate it, guys. Enjoyed it a lot.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Not Even D2.
Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you follow us on Instagram, Twitter. That's the best way to support the channel.
And all episodes released on iHeartRadio, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's going to do it. And we'll see you next week on Thursday.
Yo, bro, that was a fire episode.
OD.